Well, Fred, thank you very much for being on the podcast. And getting to know you a bit, just chatting with you. We got to talk a little bit on PSA Nationals 2023, and I got to hear a little bit about your story, and I didn't realize how fascinating your story was. You started to tell me a little bit about how you got started. A lot of listeners have watched your videos, but most people don't know your story. Most people don't realize how much work you've put into your business, how much work you've put into the brand that you've built. So I wanted to take this opportunity to talk about everywhere from you, because it's such an interesting story. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself, and we just kind of go from there.
Okay, well, first of all, it's really an honor to be on here. And second of all, the fact that you find this fascinating, I think you probably impressed pretty easily. I mean,
I don't think so.
it's kind of like time to reminisce about 20 something years. I didn't have any dog background at all. So I never even, literally, I never even owned a dog until I was 40. And I mean, to put it to you, like, it would be like, if I'd met somebody and they had a dog at their house, I wouldn't be like, oh, cool, you got a dog. Even from that perspective, I, never lived in any apartments with a dog. If I saw somebody walking down the street with a dog, I, wouldn't stop them and say, he's cool dog or anything about it. It just was really nothing to me. I didn't hate them. I didn't love them. They were just dogs, and they weren't really a part of my life at all, until I was 40. And when I was 40, well, let me back up a little bit. That leads right into that. My previous background was I had lived in the streets for a while. And a lot of this stuff, I think, played a big part in, becoming who I am. They're all part of who you are. Before I got the dog when I was 40, I was a bartender in a club for 7 years. It was actually a topless club. And that was really my only background. I was dating somebody at the time who wanted to get a dog. So I was like, okay, cool, we'll get a dog. And she wanted to get a Maltese at first. And I was like, okay, I didn't even know what a Maltese was. So we're getting ready to get this Maltese, to look at him at the last second, she changes her mind. And now she wants to get a pit bull. And I'm like, a pit bull? Okay, so I have all these visions of pit bulls, running through my head. And we start going through to look at pit bulls. We go through the paper and we just start going over to people's houses that have pit bulls. And the first thing I noticed was, as we would pop up at people's houses, they had these dogs tied in the back. Some of the people were in neighborhoods and having them fighting and all this. And that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I don't want a dog like that. So finally we run over to this, we go over to this house, and these people have these pit bulls in their house. I guess they breed them, but they're like, yeah, come on in. I'm like kind of scared to death, got some pit bulls loose in the house, but they were all really cool, and the house was nice and the people were nice. And so we took one of those dogs. But the lesson I learned out of that, as we get into this dog a little bit later, was this dog came from a show dog background. There was no working dog about it. And then later I did some stuff with working dogs. So, I kind of later came to the opinion of, the dog's just a dog. A good dog's a good dog, no matter where he's from. So that's kind of how it started.
I know one of the things you were telling me is that you basically started doing the training yourself. You saw an ad for an electronic collar, and that's kind of what segued into pretty much the rest of the story, right?
Yeah, so basically what happened was, just getting the dog, you kind of feel to yourself, I have to be responsible with this and learn a little bit about training. So I kind of read a couple books, and I went to a PetSmart class, and you know, nothing, I really didn't have comparison. So, I mean, looking back at it now, you know, the dogs weren't very well trained, but I didn't know anything about it. And what it actually reminds me of is sometimes when you get a car, for example, you get a new car, and maybe you have a, maybe you buy a new Toyota Corolla, for example. And now everybody else who has a Toyota Corolla, as you're driving down the street, you start noticing Toyota Corollas, you know, hey, and you're waving to the people because they got the same kind of car as you do. That's kind of what happened to me with the dog. Now I have a dog. I kind of got to start looking into dog stuff. I start noticing dog signs. I start noticing dogs on the street. I start noticing, you know, people that have a pit bull too, and I'm waving at him. So we get this dog, and I remember just one thing that I read in the book, and the and it said, tell the dog what you want him to do once, and then see it through that he does it. And the rest of the stuff about dog training, I didn't really have any understanding of what I was reading, but that's really kind of all I needed to know to start, at least. So I took it literally. I put a leash on my dog, and I'm sitting there watching TV, and my dog's over there in the corner, and I tell my dog to sit. And if the dog didn't sit, I would get up, literally walk across the room, pick up the leash, and make him sit. And then that's kind of what I did, and I was just following through. And then a big thing happened. I went out to the front porch one day, and there was a magazine out there, or a catalog. It was from Cabela's catalog. And I wasn't a hunter, and I had no read. I don't know how in the hell this thing ended up on my porch. But as soon as I look at this catalog, you know, and back in those days, they were always sending you all kinds of stuff on your porch. There's a picture of a dog there. And so that kind of leads me to the dog part of it. And there's a picture of an electronic collar on there. And obviously, I don't know what an electronic collar is. And just looking at the picture, and I see a picture of a remote, and I kind of get that there's some kind of shock or something going on there, and it's on the dog. But a few things hit me right away before I really even looked at it. The first thought that hit me was they wouldn't be selling this thing or put this out on a catalog if it like gave the dog a heart attack or something like that. So that part kind of was common sense to me. And so I took the catalog and I started looking at it. And then I called the company. So I called the company, and I had a pool in the backyard, and I asked them, you know, is this thing waterproof? And they said, yeah. You know, and I said, so I can put my dog in the pool and use this. It's not going to electrocute him or anything. And they go, no, it's fine. You can put him in the pool. And then I just started asking them some questions, you know. And looking at it now that I've been around a lot of collar companies, these people that answer the phone, they're just phone people, you know, they're just kind of filling your order. And I start asking them all the training questions, and they're just saying yes to everything that I'm you know, they don't really know anything about training. So I get this collar in the box.
Sure.
I still remember all of this like it was yesterday. So back in those days, you know, they didn't have collars like they have them today. They had the Tritronics companion back then. You had a battery operated remote that took a little 9-volt battery, I believe. And then you had two camera batteries, which were pretty expensive. They were about, I think, I don't know, maybe.
And you were telling me that it had different plugs, right? The collar itself had different plugs for different level ranges.
Yeah, so you'd have to put these camera batteries in there, and there's two of them, and I want to say they were $7 a piece. So every time you would put the receiver on, you know, the receiver's running the whole time, and the battery is running down. So it was never really consistent, because if the battery wears down, obviously the charge changes a little bit. And then as I opened the box, you have all of these plugs, and I still remember them like it was yesterday. A blue one was the lowest, and it was a half a contact point. It was only a half a level. So you have a black level that's a post, and then you have the different levels. So you had a You had a light blue, which was a half a level, and then it went brown was a one, and then red, and then orange, and then yellow, and then green was the highest. And also back in those days, to change it from continuous to NIC, you had a little thumb thing on the back of the back, you know, little one of those thumb toggle switches where you'd have to do it. Uh-huh. So I get this thing out, I get it out of the box, and I put the lowest plug on there, you know, I put it on there, and which was a blue one, and I put it on the dog, and I strap it on the dog, and I kind of like close my eyes, you know, because I have no idea what's going to happen, right? So I just kind of close my eyes, and I take the button, and I'm just kind of like, you know, and I'm looking, and the dog's just sitting there, you know, like nothing happened. And then I was like, I did it again and again, and nothing happened. So, mm-hmm. You know, this funny, like in retrospect, because, you know, when I think about some of the people and how they think about collars and the fact that these things mm-hmm. will go lower than any leash or any prong.
Oh, yeah.
You know, So then I go to the next level, right? So I take that off. I'm like, well, this doesn't do anything. So I take that off and I put the next one on there, and I kind of close my eyes and I just press the button, and I'm nothing happens. And then I did it a few more times and nothing happened. So I went to the third one. I put it on there and I pressed the button. And then the dog just kind of moved like a little bit. And I was like, oh, so that's it. You know, so and again, there wasn't anything at that time about, you know, any thoughts of feeding a dog first or doing this or doing that. It was just, you know, I was just seeing how this would work. And
yeah.
And then in retrospect, even with that, there's so many things that carry over. Like if you think about that as opposed to a prong collar, if you took a prong collar on a dog and you put it on them, or even a choke chain, and you put it on them for the first time and you just lightly pulled it, you know, you might get some kind of little reaction. But after you do it a few times, you know, he's kind of used to it. And that same first mm-hmm. pull doesn't work the same. Does that make sense to you? You know, so I kind of saw. I kind of saw the same thing with the collar. So that was kind of my first initial thing with the collar. But I did notice one thing. I noticed that when I put it on my dog already had some training. And when I put it on my dog and I started to have him, mm-hmm. you know, just kind of train in the same way and started doing it, the dog immediately mm-hmm. got much better than he was with all of the manual labor that I was doing before. He just, his attitude got better. He was just, mm-hmm. everything started working better. And all of a sudden, this thing was like the greatest, most fun thing I had ever come across in my life. I was just so enthralled with this device and the changes that it made in my dog that my training at the time, everything was just done in the city. And you have to remember, I have no background at the time. I have no dog background. Mm-hmm. So I would start by walking down the street with the dog. And then, you know how when you walk down the street, sometimes you would see somebody has a brick wall in front of their house. And I would stop there and I would be like, I wonder if I could get this dog to climb this wall with this collar. And I would put the dog on the wall, and I would start moving him back and forth with this collar, and you know, just worked really well. And then I would ride my bike, and I would put the collar on the dog, and I would make the dog like run on the sidewalk, and I would ride my bike in the street. And then when I would come to the, you know, where the sidewalks end and then there's street and then the next sidewalk, I would have him sit at the end of the sidewalk, ride my bike across the street, and then bring him, and then have him, you know, just take him out for a jog and have him stay on the sidewalk and me stay on the street, and just a lot of different things. And as time passed, as I got As I got older and I started learning about agility equipment, I remember the first time I actually saw a dog walk. You know, I see this dog walk and I'm like, what is this? And then when I saw them walking the dog back and forth across the dog walk, I was just like, oh, you know, this is the wall that I was already doing. And then as I came into play sports, you know, I was like, oh, you know, this is the end of the curb that I was already doing. And then when I saw like jumps, I was like, oh, this is the trees that or the bushes that I was already having them jump over. And when I saw the different retrieves, I was teaching my dog to pick up all the trash in the parks. So there was actually a video online. It was
I saw it.
Yeah, I saw that video. So that was kind of how I learned that. And
It seems like obviously you got really into, like you dove into it. Like you really, by the way you're describing it, it sounds like you got really, really into it. So what I want to ask you is, was there, you know, for 7 years you were a bartender, but at any time in your life up to that point, was there anything else that you were also like, that you really got into? Because it sounds like you're the way you're describing your discovery of the e-collar and your pursuit of, you know, the skills and learning what you did on your own, it seems like you probably have the personality where you find something and you dive really into it. Was there anything like that in your life up to that point that you had gotten into as well?
Well, when I was younger, I played a lot of sports, but and I kind of liked that, but eventually it, you know, the competition caught up with me as I got a little bit older and I didn't, you know, play a little bit of stuff in college, but yeah, this had a whole different effect on me, you know, just had a, you know, before you knew it, I was taking the dog just everywhere all day long, every day. And, you know, people were coming up and asking me like, wow, you know, and that gave me the idea to just start doing it. So that leads to another big story that happened along the way here. So as I was in my last few years of bartending, I started really getting into this. I had a sports car and I sold that and I got a van. And on the van, I put Sit Mean Sit Dog Training. I just came up with the name, you know, and as I got so much into it that I figured I'm going to quit my job as a bartender, do this full time. I'm just going to go out there and, you know, I'm just winging it now. I don't have any business background. I don't have any background. I don't know anything about dog training. At this point in time, I still have never seen a seminar. I'm just so enthralled with the results that I'm getting and the attention that I'm getting everywhere I go. And I'm starting to make videos. I was one of the first people on YouTube on YouTube making dog training videos just regularly. And at the time when I'm making these videos, I'm just thinking like, I'm sure professional dog trainers can do all of this stuff because I don't even really know what I'm doing. But it was just so much fun showing it. And I think what led to the videos was, it was just the fact of everywhere I was going, you know, people were coming up to me like, wow, you know, do you train dogs? That's unbelievable. You know, because I was doing stuff in public and blowing whistles and the dogs are running all over the place. And I was training in the middle of a dog park, you know, and I was just doing stuff kind of everywhere. And so I quit my bartending job and I went for like 2 weeks and I didn't get any business. I didn't get any business at all. And I was like, I can't make a living at this. So I called my friends who owned a bunch of sports bars that I had known for a long time. And I said, hey, I said, I need a job. And they said, what's the problem? Aren't you doing that dog training thing or whatever? I go, yeah, but that's not going to work out. So they said, sure, we'll give you a job as a bartender again, but you're going to have to start, you know, near the bottom. I can't put you in the busiest place right away. They owned about 20 bars. So, so I said, all right. So they started me graveyard at a place. And so they said, meet the guy at 10 o'clock at night. And, you know, he'll go over the bar with you and everything. So I go over there at 10 o'clock. I meet the guy. He's going over all the register and the beer and where the wine is and everything. And then right near the end while he's showing me all this, he says to me, in the corner over there, there's a baseball bat. And I said, well, what's the baseball bat for? And he said, well, you know, this is graveyard. And, you know, you might have a fight at some point in time. And just in case you need it, it's right there. And as soon as he said that, you know, that was like a gift from somewhere. As soon as he said that, I checked out. Because now I'm like 40 years old, you know, I'm not going to get into like bar fights again and doing it. I just was over all of that. So I didn't say it to him, but at that point I was like, I'm not doing this. So the very next day I called my friends and I said to them, hey, you know, I really appreciate the opportunity, but I can't take the job. And they said, well, why was he mean to you, or you didn't like him, or you didn't like the people, or what? And no, everything was fine. No problem. I just can't do it. And they said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to do the dog thing. And they said, well, I thought that's why you asked me to come over here, because the dog thing wasn't working. And I said, well, I got to do it. And then at that point in time, I had to make it work. And I think that's a good lesson for everybody. You know, sometimes people go into a business or even their dog training business, and I see it a lot. And I can't say that what worked for me would work for everybody, but sometimes people do things and I see them like, yeah, I like this dog training thing, but I can't support it. So I'm, you know, I have a part-time job doing this and I don't want to give that up. But I think in my case, that was the best thing that could have happened to me, because now I had no choice but to make that work.
You had to make it work because your safety net was just out. You had to burn the boats.
Yeah, it was gone. It was all gone. And so now I had to put all of my energy into that. So I don't know if your situation is similar, or you started with one foot in or one foot out, but I think it's different for everybody.
Yeah, but at some point, everybody has that, you know, that choice. You know, everybody has that option of, well, you know, I could get a job and get that predictable income. I could go back to what I was doing before. Everybody at some point, I would imagine, if they own a business, has that option towards the beginning, or maybe at some point, even if the business is going really well, but then the business, you know, goes down a bit. So I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I think a lot of people that have been in business will probably agree with you on that as well, that the best way to do it is just to cut your options out. And just like you, I mean, it was, like you said, it was a gift. If that guy hadn't showed you that baseball bat, it would be a different story.
Yeah, it'd be a different story. And you know what else is kind of ironic about the whole thing is, you know, now that I'm a little older, I'm into, you know, I do a lot of investing, and it reminds me a lot of any industry that's disrupted. You know, when you think about companies like Tesla, or really anything that's been changed, anything in life, in the history, that an industry has been disrupted, it's always been disrupted by an outside force, somebody not within the industry. So I think that me not knowing any of this stuff really, really played a huge part in me going down avenues that I wouldn't have been able to go down if I had a dog training background, because people would tell me you can't do this, or you can't do it that way. And that just led to just an unlimited amount of experimentation.
Well, and because you didn't have a background in dog training, nobody told you, no, you can't do it that way. No, you shouldn't do it that way. No, you need to do this first. So, you know, and another one is, you are not afraid to push that button. You know, you were not afraid to experiment and to try it. And I think part of the genius of that whole thing, because you know, people may or may not like, you know, you or sit, I mean, sit or may or may not like e-collars, but nobody can deny that your name is a big name in the industry. Sit Means Sit is a big name in the industry. And so when we revisit the early parts of how this got started, it's because nobody was there to tell you, no, Fred, you can't do it this way. Or you didn't have that back, you know, that background information that told you, no, I need to use food first, or I need to do this first, or I need to do it this way first, or I need to do, you know, I need to do it for this amount of time first. And you're absolutely correct. Every industry, they do get these big shifts in technology and in everything. And it happens because of somebody else that was not part of the industry originally.
Yeah, the iPhone, it happened that they weren't in the, Apple wasn't in the phone. Apple wasn't in the phone industry. Mm-hmm. Tesla wasn't in the car industry. I don't even think Henry mm-hmm. Ford it was in the car industry. So then what started to enlighten me a little bit more was I think I was on like MySpace or something back then doing videos and putting dogs around distractions. So I didn't really have any knowledge of like you're supposed to start the dog, you know, around nothing and then, you know, mm-hmm. let do whatever mm-hmm. 5 years later, bring him into distraction. I didn't know any of that. So I was showing stuff around distraction, and I was just assuming, like, I wasn't assuming anything. I mean, I didn't know what other dog trainers were doing. I was just showing it and figuring all of those people could probably do this twice as good. So it started to get on the internet. You know, dog trainers started getting a hold of me, and they're like, wait a minute. You know, you can't take that dog who's dog aggressive and have them start walking around dogs like that. And I was just like, what do you mean? You know, I showed it there. And they got really, you know, they were wondering, and they would say to me, like, can I come by? You know, can I come over and visit you and watch you do all this stuff? And I was like, yeah, you know, no problem. I was always an open book. So they would come, and then they would go. And I was starting to see, like, that they just in their attitude, like that they were just really kind of, you know, amazed by it. And then I was doing that's funny. We're both in the PSA, which reminds me, the pit bull that I got, eventually I started doing some protection work. And back then they had NAPD, which was, mm-hmm. which later became PSA. And that was my first experience with any kind of dog sport. And when I went to go see it, you know, most people now, when they see like PSA, they're used to other things being like very patterned. And then they see PSA and they're like, well, my experience was just the opposite. And whereas I was starting with distraction, and now I come and I see NAPD, which is, you know, just a small segment of what PSA is today, but it was still a lot of distraction. And when I saw it, I was just like, well, yeah, I mean, how else would you do it? You know, so it didn't really hit me the same way that PSA hits other people. And, you know, I went mm-hmm. on and I won a national in my, I think the first year I was doing it. I had set the obedience record in NAPD at the time. And then I got a chance to do a radio show and a television show, and I started to do that. And then I had this lady come over, and what I started doing on my radio show was I would start getting dog training people on. And this woman was passing through town, and she had her own facility in Tucson, Arizona. She's passed away since then. And she asked me, you know, since she was visiting, could I be on your radio show? And I said, you know, sure. I'm always looking for people. So she came on the radio show. And before she came on, I had my dog out there and I was showing her some stuff. And she said, would you mind, like, could you do a seminar for us? And I was like, oh, wait a minute. Whoa, wait a second. You know, I was like, I've never done a seminar in my life. And she's like, well, I don't care. You know, I like what I'm seeing. Can you do a seminar? And I said, you know, yeah, I mean, I guess I'll try. So I drove down there and there was 60 people down there that she invited. And she called me a couple days before the seminar and she said to me, hey, the head of our canine department out here wants to come to the seminar. Do you have any problem with that? And I said, no, hey, listen, you know, I said, I'm not claiming to be any, you know, police trainer or anything. I go, but I, you know, I don't care who comes. I just do what I do and I'm go out there and do it. And so we get over there and I'm training my dogs. And before we start, this guy that's the head of canine comes up to me and he says, hey, you know, I just want to let you know that I can only stay like 5 to 10 minutes. I just stopped by and you know, I just wanted to stop by. Mm-hmm. I said, hey, I really appreciate your time and appreciate you coming. And, you know, even if it's just 10 minutes, I appreciate it. So he comes over there, he watches this. Captain Haggerty, who was a very famous, he was a very famous movie trainer at the time. He was actually there. And I just took dog after dog after dog and just went out there and just did what I do. And there was one dog there that was very scared of everything. And the transition in that dog was just, it really turned around. And Captain Haggerty ended up doing an article on the seminar and that got a lot of play. And then the police officer, what happened was he not only stayed longer than 10 minutes, but he ended up going home that night and coming back the next day and inviting the SPCA from Arizona and all of his handlers to come back. And so then that just led into doing seminars all over the country. And I was booked at that time, probably 48 weekends a year.
Wow.
And what was funny was I never charged a dime for a seminar ever. And I was booked a lot. The only thing that I did was I charged for my room and my airfare. And I told the people that were having it, you can have whoever you want come. I put no restrictions on the dogs. I don't care what kind of dogs come. Everybody's going to get involved. I really wasn't doing like a classroom type of thing. I was just bringing each dog up. Everything was just working the dogs. And I even paid for my own food. And I just loved it. You know, I just loved it. And the love of the game was there. And then that just blossomed and blossomed. And then which is leading us into how the school started. Do you want to hear that story? So
let me ask you a quick question before we go into that. A couple of questions. So you didn't charge for the seminars. Was that because A, you didn't know, B, you didn't feel like you should charge? Or was there another reason why you didn't charge?
I just felt at by this time, I just felt that the product was going to speak for itself. And I was a big believer in doing everything in public, you know, so I also felt that if I put the incentive on the people and let them keep all the money, they would have more incentive to bring more people. So I didn't put a price on it. I'm sorry?
It was like a business strategy?
I guess in retrospect, it was a business strategy, but I had no strategy.
I see.
You know, I had no strategy. I just had experience again and again doing all of this in public. And I think that that's a really good definition of you know, can you do it in public? You know, can you do it in public? If it's, you know, I mean, I'm sure some people think like, yeah, that's good for some kind of dogs, but I didn't put any type of restriction on the type of dog. So people were bringing scared dogs. People were bringing timid dogs. And at this point in time, I never had ever seen a seminar. So I didn't really know what went on in a seminar. This is all I knew. All I knew was that's you don't crazy. You know, like when I go to seminars now, they get up there and they, you know, they're talking theory for half the seminar and you might get a little bit of work in or whatever. And I'm not being judgmental. Sure. I didn't know any of that. And I didn't believe in any of that. And just the people, like, you could see it, like now it meant so much to me that now they're enjoying like being with their dog because we're doing this in front of everybody. And even today, you know, I have videos from all those seminars back then. And that was just normal for me. So,
you enjoyed the process.
Yeah. It was all about the process. It was all about the people being happy. And it was all about, you know, I just knew like there was going to be some dramatic stuff that was going to happen there. I just knew because the more dogs that were there, it was just going to happen. And that kind of put me on the map a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I distinctly, you know, stuff is coming back to me. I distinctly remember, you know, you were asking about the business plan. You know, a funny story about that. I did a seminar in Kentucky. And at this point in time, we had a few locations. I want to say we probably had, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 locations. We weren't franchised yet. And this guy was there and he had texted me before he came to the seminar. And he said, hey, you know, I might be interested in becoming a sit mean sit. Will you have any time for me there? Once I get there, I said, listen, I make time for everybody. My company's policy has always been nobody waits. And anybody who knows me, I'm right back to them with any text message, any phone call, anything. It's just the way that I am. It's not a sales thing. It's just me. So mm-hmm. I told him, sure, you know, no problem. So he comes over there. He goes to the seminar. He sees all the stuff going on. And then when it gets over, he says, can we sit down? And I have a few questions for you, you know, that maybe you can answer about your business or whatever. Sure, no problem. So we sit in this RV. One of our location owners was there with us, Darren Shepherd. He was sitting there with us at the time. And the guy starts asking me, you know, he asked me a couple questions and we're only like 5 minutes in and he's got a notebook with all these questions. And he says to me, next question is, what's your business plan? And I just stop and I look at him and I said, what's a business plan? And he, you know, he like thinks I'm joking, you know,
right.
He goes, no, seriously. Like, what's your business plan? And I go, no, I'm serious. Like, what's a business? And he says, now he knows I'm serious. And he says, you mean to tell me you don't even have a business plan? And I go, no, I don't know what one is. So I can't really. I guess I don't. And he said, well, I'm certainly not going to go into business with somebody that doesn't have a business plan. And I just looked at him, you know, and I just said, you know, that's fine. We'll see what happens with you, with your business plan and what happens, you know, as time goes by. And I think having this conversation with you as a business owner, you know, looking at it in retrospect, you know, part of it might be that was kind of stupid, you know, for me to say that or not to have a business plan. But really, when I think about it, even if I had a business plan, like I couldn't have planned on all this stuff. You know, it was just happening. And I was just trying to make a living. And I was just really just enjoying what I was doing. There's no way I could have sat down and wrote out the script of the way it happened. So, I don't know.
It all happened so organically, right? Like you were
totally.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing I would have done any differently, but I think the thing that drove it the most was the heart. You know, my heart was just how much I just enjoyed. You said it really well, the process. You know, the process was just there. You know, from the day I started, I was out there every day.
I loved it. That is so cool. That is so cool. Now let me ask you a question and maybe a little bit of a different perspective. I know, you know, and it's happened to me, and I know by talking to other trainers, it happens to them too. So a lot of us, and I can speak from personal experience, a lot of us, when we first start training dogs, we get like that. We get in a zone and we're like, wow, this is amazing. You're learning this. You're learning this. You get this rush of just, you know, emotions where you're like, wow, you know, this dog is getting better. This dog is getting better. But then what happens is, again, I can speak from experience, and I know that people feel this way. At some point, that kind of fades a little bit. You know, like the novelty kind of goes away a bit because you do it day in and day out, day in and day out. And then you get to a point where you have to almost like motivate yourself to do it. You have to discipline yourself to do it when you don't want to do it. Did you ever experience that? Or were you always on this high of, wow, this is great. Wow, this is great. The process is amazing. Did you ever get to that point, or were you always pumped about this?
Well, as the business got bigger, I mean, there was parts of the business that I handed off or didn't like to do or whatever. But the main thing of what drove the business, the actual training of the dogs and experimentation and all of the, you know, learning and all of the being out there and doing all that even to this day has never wavered. You know, I mean, people have asked me a lot, you know.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, now that you are where you are, you know, you're going to probably sell the business here. We get offers all. There was just no way I would sell this business. And people have said to me, you know, there's always price or aren't you going to? And I, you know, I get stuff and I'll send it to friends. Like, you'll see me just answer them. Like, they'll, like, companies will want to buy us. And I'll just, like, I won't even, like, we don't even have any desire to, like, listen to what they have to say. And I say to them, I'm not the only person. There's people that own all kinds of businesses that are much, much bigger than ours. that have been in families for years that they can't. This is who I am. This is me. So, I mean, what am I going to do? Like, I've never had any desire to, like, well, I'm going to sell this thing and learn to fly an airplane or, you know, go skydiving or whatever. You know, I mean, this is what I do. And
see that,
this is what we,
that is so fascinating, you know, because again, one of the biggest talking points with dog trainers is something called burnout. You hear dog trainers talk about this all the time, about burnout, right? They're like, oh, you got to be careful not to burn yourself out. You got to take breaks. You know, you got to do all of this. But in your case, it doesn't seem like that's even in your vocabulary. You're just so devoted with every part of your being into this that I think it's fascinating that you just stayed on this high the entire time of, I love the process so much that I can't even think about selling it or doing something else because this is who I am. That in itself is very impressive. And a lot of people don't get into that. A lot of people don't get like that. That's just how it is. A lot of people get burnt out even doing the things they love, which again is one of the reasons why Fred Hassen is a big name. Sid is a big name. And it's very impressive, very fascinating.
There's just so many things, you know, there's so many, I mean, it's a long story and I don't want to, you know, there's just so many boxes to check. You know, there was like, I'm just reminiscing about a few things. Like one of the things that I remember was when I first started seeing seminars, that was very enlightening to me because, you know, I'd go to go see a seminar as I started getting involved in sport training, and I would go to a sport seminar, a sport dog seminar, and I've seen a few people in my day. And the first thing that jumped out at me was how good a quality of dog that they got to deal with. If you're going to a sports seminar, you know, if you're going to, we're both in PSA, if you're going to a PSA seminar, I'm not saying that at a seminar, not all the dogs are perfect or whatever, but it's nothing like what we're dealing with the general public. And when I was doing seminars, inviting everybody and anybody and scared dogs and timid dogs and this dog and that dog. And I was like, this is like a dream come true, because the whole program and everything we do works so much better when you have a better quality of dog. And I think that goes for everything in life. If you're a basketball coach, you know, you're a better coach if you got, you see it all the time. You see coaches that have a great team, and then the players, you know, they retire or whatever, and now that same coach doesn't have such a good team anymore. But what really struck out at me at the seminars was I noticed like the changes were like nothing. Like there was very little changes. Like when people seminar, you know, at the end of 2 days, everybody that came there basically looked the same as when they came. And I was just like, there was just nothing in me to like, I want to go down that road. You know, there was things along the way where I would start seeing this other stuff. And I was like, you know, I don't want to, I like it the way it is. So, it really resonated a lot with me. And there was also, you know, a lot of people along the way. I don't want to, I'll make sure I get back to that, to the people that have had a big, you know, big influence on me. But let's get to the school for a second and how this started. During my time when I was doing seminars, and like I said, I had no business plan, I did a seminar for a dog training school. here I am, and a school, you know, that's been around for years. I don't want to mention the school, but they every year or so they have somebody come in, and you know, because they're very open-minded and letting other people, you know, show what they have, and they want to hear it from the source. So it's a yearly thing where they have all their graduates. So they have all their graduates over there, and I. You know, I always came a day early. I always brought my dog. And so I was out there in a field right outside the hotel, you know, just doing what I always do. And this woman came out and she was watching a little bit. And she's like, hey, you know, are you by any chance the guy who's doing the thing tomorrow? You know, because she didn't know what I looked like or anything. And sure. and I said, yeah. And she said, oh, that's cool. And I said, you know, and just me, I'm like always ready to do it, you know. So I was like, you want to go get your dog? You know, seminar started the next day, and now you know, I'm on a long flight and everything else is just always the same. So I said, go get your dog. And she's like, well, my dog is not gonna work for you, you know, my dog doesn't like men. And I was like, go get your dog. So she goes over to the hotel, she goes over to her room, she gets her dog, she brings him out, she's getting ready to hand me, and she's telling me the whole thing. And so I'm just like, here, give me the dog. So I just like take the dog from her and I start working the dog. And like right away, this dog starts like, you know, sitting, looking at me. You know, it was just, you know, some demonstrations go better than others, but this went really, really well. And she was just like amazed. She's like, my dog never looks at me like that, you know. And she's like, and he never will go with a man or whatever. He doesn't like men. And I was like, well, you know, just, you know, and you'll see it tomorrow. We're going to take everybody out there. So I go the next day and I start the seminar. And the first thing that hits me is I'm like thinking, these people are all graduates of this school, but because of all the stuff we can do remotely, like the dog sitting, you know, away from you and all this other stuff, I'm like thinking, I'm going to do something here. So I got everybody together. They all had their dog. We went out to this little like place that they had in the back, and there's probably 40 people there, and they all went with the dog. I go, okay, this is my very first intro to them. I go, okay, everybody just kind of spread out. So they spread out, and I said, just kind of let your dogs loose a little bit. I go, I'm sure all of you guys know how your dogs know how to sit, right? And they go, yeah. And they started kind of laughing and giggling. Of course, you know, we're graduates. Of course, our dogs can sit. So I made sure there was no dog aggressive dogs in there. And then I said, just let your dogs loose or whatever. Let them play for a minute. And I go, and then on count of three, you guys all have your dog sit. And so, you know, obviously there's all this distraction and all these other dogs and they're from the dog and almost nobody could do it, you know, and I kind of knew that was going to happen. And I just said, oh, that's not too bad. You know, it's pretty good. You know, so we came inside and this same woman was over there in the front row when we got halfway through the seminar. And she comes up to me and she says, hey, you know, how do I learn more about this? And I go, what do you mean learn more about it? I'm showing you exactly what I'm doing. I'm telling you what I'm doing. I'm answering your questions. I'm taking dog after dog. I'm showing you. And she's like, no. I mean, don't you have some kind of school or something that I could go to? And I like pause for a second. And I was like, yeah, I got a school. And she's like, really? She's like, can I get the, you know, what do I have to do? And I said, I just left the stuff back home. I'll get it for you when I get home. So I went home and I just, you know, this is what I'm talking about, where things just happened, you know, and now I have to put it together. And she was, I think she was our first student. You know, so I just kind of did the same thing. I kind of put her out there and had her going around and learning. It was all hands on. And, you know, so that's kind of how the school starts. Sometimes you just got to, you know, you got to
make it happen. I like that. You have to, sometimes you have to commit first and then figure it out later.
Yeah. You know?
Commit first, then come up with the plan.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have any visions of grandeur, like, you know, I want to make this thing a big school or a franchise or whatever. Things just fell into place. But what made it all fall into place was the constant commitment and the, you know, and then, you know, just changing a lot of people's lives, you know, where we have a lot of people now that, you know, own multiple locations. And we started getting people that weren't from dog backgrounds, which I like, you know, we have, you know, like top people, you know, just thousands and thousands of customers and you know, it's just all worked out. It's all worked out really well.
There was a story you told me when we were talking, and it involved some bird dog training where this lady who was very experienced with bird dogs was telling you, oh, no, you can't do that. And you kept showing her that you could. Remember that? Remember that story? Is there any way you could kind of revisit that?
Yeah, that was another thing that, you know, there was points along the way that really kind of, because you have to remember, you know, I'm kind of naive to this whole thing. I don't really think I'm on to anything. I'm kind of thinking like there's nothing I'm really doing that people that have been training dogs for a long time can't do or don't do or don't know. I just want to say one other thing before I get back to that. The other thing was how I wanted to touch on this as far as the public's perception of e-collar training goes. I really want to touch on this just for a second. You know, you'll read a lot on the internet where, oh, general public, they don't like it, or they think this, or they think that. I really don't think that there's more of a scientific playground than sit mean sit dog training. You're talking about, you know, 170 locations. You're talking about rich people, poor people, black people, white people, everything, in every part of society. In locations all over the place. Some of our trainers are better than others, all kinds of different clients. And, you know, if you just took a bunch of random clients, like thousands of them, and that was true, you'd think we'd be kicked out of like every house that we go into, or half of them. It's just not the way it is. It's just not, you know, they, once they see the result, yeah, sure. Sometimes there's a little bit of hesitancy, but if you can't back up what you're saying, it's going to go right out the window, you know? So, We just didn't have any problem at all with people accepting. The only kind of blowback we got was really just from dog trainers. And I never even understood that, you know, because I would be like, hey, you should be like jumping up and down that we're coming into your town because, you know, think of the good news, you know, you got all this really nice and great and fantastic work and training in ours. You know, you're going to say that it's not working or anything and people aren't going to buy into it. That's kind of competition that you're not going to have to worry about. But it just didn't work out. It never happened that way. It was, the clients were, they bought into it because they care about their dogs. You know, some people might buy into or might think like, oh, they don't care. They just want the dog to, you know, just chill out. But nothing could be further than the truth. If you think that you're going to go to a pet client's house and that dog's going to lose his spirit and they're just going to buy it, you know, that's just questioning the people's intelligence. I think that they're, you know, just not true. So what happened was there was I started dabbling in retriever training and I tried to learn it online. You know, I'd watch videos, but the retriever people had like, they have a language of their own. All the things that they talk about and the terms that they use, I had never heard any of them before, and I was never a hunter. So I didn't really understand what I was seeing. But there was a guy in Texas that kind of took a liking to me on the internet, just watching what I was doing with my pit bull and trying to do some stuff. And he said to me, hey, you know, I'd like to send you one of my dogs and see what you can do as a retriever. I said, great. So he sends me this dog and I start messing around with him. And you got to remember, I'm learning the retriever training on the streets. You know, I'm running them down sidewalks to learn straight lines. You know, those are the things that I know. And you know what? I wouldn't change it for the world. You know, the sidewalk and you got a wall and you got, and I'm using, you know, bushes for jumps to build speed, and I'm using, you know, everything in the environment. And so he comes out to visit me when the dog's like 7 months old. He said, let me see what you got. So I take him out there, and I mean I'm sure I wasn't doing all the retriever stuff, but he's certainly impressed. And he says, you need to go to a retriever trial. And he goes, you need to see what's going on in a trial and I'll take you to one. I said, all right, great. So in the meantime, there was this woman who wrote a retriever book. And at the time I was doing this, there was really nothing out there on electronic collars. You couldn't find anything anywhere. You couldn't find books on it. You couldn't find articles on it. You couldn't find. So, you know, and there was trainers around that I would see that, you know, hey, don't do that or don't do this. Mm-hmm. Or so I there was really nowhere to learn. So I'm reading this book and I'm trying to understand it. And I really can't understand it. I don't want to mention her name, but anyway, so he takes me to the retriever training to a trial. And we're coming back from the trial and we're walking through the parking lot. And this woman is walking and the guy who was the judge calls her out by name, but you know, I just hear a name. I don't know that this is the same woman that wrote the book, you know? So she comes over and I said, as she's walking over, I said, you know, who's this? And he says her first and last name. And then it clicks, you know, I'm like, oh my God, this is the woman that wrote the book. So I'm like, I'm meeting Santa Claus. Like I'm just like, this is like the most exciting day of my life. Like there's no information anywhere. Sure. I'm trying to understand this book. This woman wrote the book. I'm right. And now she's right in front of my face. And I'm like, I can't even talk. You know, I'm just like, oh my God, I can't. So we get into a conversation about training by ourselves. And I'm explaining to her how I put a dog on a place board, and then I go out there and I throw the bumper, and then I send the dog over there. And by this time, I can do all kinds of stuff, you know, with a collar. Mm-hmm. I can run the dog by me, run him back. So I'm explaining to her how I run the dog by me, have him pick it up, come back to the thing and have him drop the bumper. And she says to me, you can't do that. And I was like, what do you mean you can't do that? She's like, a dog that is retrieving will only retrieve it to hand. They're not going to drop the bumper like out somewhere. And like, I'm like thinking to myself, like, she doesn't understand what I'm trying to tell her. You know, she doesn't understand mm-hmm. what I'm saying, because there's no way that I can do this and she can't do it. There's just no way. So I'm explaining it to her, you know, again and again. She's like, no, you can't do that. And you know, a retriever won't do that. And I'm like, oh. And so I go, wait a minute, I got my dog here. I go, I'll show you what I'm talking about. And then you'll, you know, it'll make sense to you. And you'll be like, oh, yeah. It's like, okay. So I go and I go get my pit bull out. And I go, what do you want to see? And she says, throw the bumper over there. She says, have the dog go run out there and get it and pick it up and sit. And then drop the bumper right there where the dog's sitting. So I guess in the retriever world, they don't. I mean, and I'm like thinking to myself, like, are you serious? Like, okay. So I throw the bumper out there and I send the dog over there. The dog picks it up. I have her sit. And then just to pile on a little bit, just to make my point, I have the dog drop it, pick it up, drop it, pick it up, drop it, pick it up. And then she's just kind of like, okay, can you like have that dog like come back and like drop it while it's moving on the way back? And I was like, okay. So I did it. But, you know, that was just another point along the way where it started hitting me that like I was doing some things that weren't pretty much traditional. So that had a big impact. It took a long time before I wasn't intimidated by every dog trainer that I saw. You know, it took years before, you know, because I really wasn't in that world.
That is interesting. So your self-image sort of grew as you started to have these experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem was, you know, along the lines, every once in a while I'd get into it with somebody, but I think it was more of a thing that I just figured that I wasn't communicating myself properly to them, mm-hmm. that they could certainly do a lot of this stuff. They just didn't understand what I was saying. But as time went on, I think they're just very, you know, they were just restricted in the knowledge that they had and the tools that they had. And I think they were handcuffed. A lot of people are handcuffed, even clients, they're handcuffed because they're in such a belief system that their dog is that way. You've experienced that. Somebody just like, oh no, my dog, you know, he does this because, you know, the previous owner or whatever it might be, that it's very hard for them to get out of that mindset. And as long as they're in that mindset, it's hard for them to, does that make sense? It's hard for them to, to get over that hurdle. And I think it's the same with, you know, with dog trainers to a certain degree.
I think personally that's even worse with dog trainers. At least the client doesn't know, you know, until you tell them. But a lot of dog trainers, because they learn, and then a lot of dog trainers do this, they learn from a person and they go, okay, so this is the person I want to learn from, and I'm going to listen to everything they say, right? Or they'll go, well, then I'll listen to these people right here. These trainers are the ones that I listen to. These are my mentors. And it almost becomes like religion, you know, like, you know, this is the way I do it because this is the way I learned it, because this is the way my mentors do it. And so what ends up happening is they do kind of put themselves in a box. And that's what, you know, that's what happens. That's what you noticed. And that's what, you know, that's what you didn't have. You didn't have that box because you didn't have the mentors. You know, you didn't have the, you know, the, those self-imposed beliefs because you came from no doctoring background. You kind of discovered it on your own.
Yeah, I didn't have, and it never let me down. Like every time I would get into a new or stumble across an arena. Like I remember the first time I saw scent work. You know, I didn't know anything about scent work, and I remember seeing it. But all that's going through my mind while I'm watching this is like, how can I do that with a collar? Like that's all that's going through my mind. And then as I started doing that with police department, it just there was nothing anywhere, at least with me, that it didn't end up being able to better the product that they had. I remember doing an agility seminar one time where this woman had seen me and, you know, just do a couple things. Again, it was just from the background of doing stuff on the streets. And she said, you know, will you do an agility seminar for me? And I said, well, I don't know anything about agility. You know, they're going to know that. They're going to know that I've never competed. They're going to know that, you know, if they ask me any questions about an agility trial, they're going to know that. And they were like, she was like, I don't care. You know, you'll figure it out. And so we got to doing the seminar. And about a week before, she was like, I don't know what to tell these people because they're all asking me, like, who is this guy? And does he have any agility? I said, well, just have them come. So I remember when I showed up, there's this agility field, and I don't have any agility equipment, but I can relate to everything out there. You know, they have a teeter totter, and they have a dog walk, and they had a tire that the dog would run through. So I took my dog out there, you know, and I'm running him like 100 yards up this dog walk, you know, a dog walk 100 yards away, and stopping him on a dime and turning him and making him face that way and this way and coming this way and running through the tires with the thing angled, you know, in different directions. And it was just all I knew. And that kind of got their attention. And then I just kind of did it my own way, you know, like when I was teaching them to get on the dog walk, you know, it was just kind of like that was one big placeboard to me, you know, and I was just teaching it like that. And everybody was like, this stuff takes weeks, you know, but I didn't have a comparison of exactly what they meant by this takes weeks, but it was all I knew. I remember my friend in New York called me out to do a ring sports seminar. And I was like, I don't know anything about ring sport. He was like, you'll figure it out. So I went over there to do a ring sport. And that was the very first time I saw like a palisade, like with a dog going over a palisade. Mm-hmm. And it was the very first time I ever saw this was at the seminar. It was the very first time I ever saw an object guard. You know, I told them, you know, I was like, I mean, I'm smart enough to know that I can't go over there and pretend like I know something that I don't. You know, you're going to have a conversation and they're going to know. So I like that. I like dealing from a place that I didn't know it. So what I liked about it was like, I was in a no lose situation because I looked at it like this, especially when I started doing police seminars. I looked at it like this. Hey, you know, you've been a police officer for 20 something years. I don't know anything about being a police officer. So it just should make common sense that you should be able to do all this stuff. You know, if you can't do this 100 times better than I can, I'm going to be pretty disappointed, you know, because I just, you know, I don't know it, but it was all interrelated. And then I did dock dogs, and that was I went to the world championships with that. That was probably one of the prouder moments, only because it's such a positive only sport. I don't think there's anything more positive only than dock dogs. And our company went in there and just, you know, we did really, really well. We dominated that, you know, so I had to check a lot of the boxes. And I think that it's important for dog trainers. I think it's important to check the boxes. I think it's important, like what you're doing. I think it's important that you're competing, because if you don't, there's other dog trainers that are out there that can show all kinds of stuff, but there's always going to be that question. You know, there's always going to be that question in their mind, you know, like, you know, I don't care how you're training, like, you know, how can you do it out there with nothing on, whether you're, mm-hmm. whether you, you know, using food or whatever your training method is, you have to check those boxes. I think that, you know, you have to compete. You don't have to do anything, but you're going to be questioned with these things at some point in time from a business side. Can you check that box? You know, can you check that box, and not just yourself? Can you show the consistency of not just you, but everybody around you doing well in that area, you know, from a business side? I mean, I know so many good dog trainers that have done really, really well out there in their specific sports. And some of them have even won multiple championships, but they've never been able to make it in the pet dog world. And that's just another box. And I think that box is important because that's where you're dealing with a lot of different dogs, and that's going to put your system to the test. At least I think that helped me in my sport dog and in everything else more than anything, rather than just always, you know, this dog doesn't have it, I'll throw him off to the side. This dog doesn't have it, you know, and I'm only dealing with select, which I understand. If you're doing sports, you have no reason to, you know, compete with a scared, timid dog. But there's a lot of stuff that you're going to
learn. Oh, yeah. No, definitely. I agree. So another question to kind of start to, you know, put it together. How did you go from all of that, and what was the process to growing Sit to what it is now? You know, like, there's obviously been a lot of growth throughout all these years. What stage is it at right now? How did you get here, and what's sort of the next chapter?
So we're at 170 locations, and I think it's just so important to, you know, give thanks to all of these people that have done it, and the lives that they've changed, not only with clients but in their own work and what they've been able to accomplish. You know, I've been training up in years, and I don't know any dog trainers that have more than one location. I mean, there might be one of them. I don't know how many, you know, but if you really stop and think about that, you can't stop that rate of growth if you wanted to. We have many, many people with multiple locations. Some as young as in their late 20s and have 5 or 6 locations. So you really can't stop that, you know, because they're spraying, and you have to be able to do that. But I think the biggest changes that we have, I think Chris Altair, who has come to us, he actually, I met him. He had seen some of the videos, and he met me at a police seminar. I mean, at a police conference. And, you know, when you look at Chris, he's like, you know, he's, I don't know, 6'2", 6'3", short hair. He looks like a police officer. So I just assumed he was a police officer. He said, no, I'm not a police officer. Right. I said, well, what are you doing here? And he said, I just came to learn more about training. And I was like thinking, what are you coming to, you know, to a police seminar for? And one thing led to another. And he got into our system, and now me and him teach our school. But I think all of the stuff that he's done to make this run with it, with the school, with both of us, I think we're heading into an even further direction. Cause I've had other people help me with the school over the years, but I've never had anybody that's developed like Chris has. So I think that the years ahead and the plans that we have and the different areas that we're going to go, I don't want to announce a lot of that stuff quite yet. Sure. I think that, you know, the beginning is just started. And I also wanted to mention Alfredo Rivera, who's been with me for a long time. He used to be the vice president of an auto company. And he's been with me almost since the beginning, and he runs the franchise side of it. But I think the biggest thing is what our company is the ethics that we have, and just having all of these people and that are just really, really good people, and I think it's we're going to just get a lot bigger and a lot stronger here in the upcoming times.
Well, I can definitely see that. I mean, you still have the passion. You have good people around you, and right now, like I said earlier, you know, Sid means Sid. Fred Hassan, it's a household name. You know, everybody knows who Fred Hassan is. Everybody knows Sid means Sid. So all of that combined with the right people and the right attitude, which you guys obviously seem to have.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing the PSA thing, but there's one thing that I, you know, putting out videos and stuff with this, but I never wanted to be in a box. You know, I don't want to be known as a, I definitely want to get a 3 on my dog. I definitely have 3 dogs that I'm going to be competing this year, but I don't want to be that guy. You know, I'm a protection guy. I want the company to always show their versatility, their ability to train all the different dogs, their ability to be able to get to multiple businesses, their ability to, and because of the clients being so happy and coming back or whatever, this has given us the opportunity to have many trainers that are making millions of dollars. I mean, it's just unheard of in the dog training business, but that just comes with clients. That doesn't come, that comes with a lot of clients, and it comes with integrity, and it comes with just a repeatable, you know, procedure that these people are going to, you know, continue to grow. And I think I use like Apple as an example. You know, the people with the iPhone started in their garage, but you can't help but the product. You know, you can't just market something and be a good marketer if you don't have a product. It just doesn't work that way. I mean, yeah, you might be able to, you know, pull the wool over a couple people's eyes, but you won't be able to withstand the test of time. And this has gone on now for 20 something years, where we've been, you know, on top of the game and showing it, you know, for all of these years, you know, so. In a lot of different areas. And so I'd like to, you know, continue down that path.
Well, thank you, Fred. It's been such a great interview, and your story is so inspiring. You know, it really is. I think a lot of people that you know, did not know a whole lot about your background are going to be inspired. You've been able to maintain that same level of intensity from day one all the way till now and into the future. So thank you for being, you know, thank you again for sharing your story, and thank you for being in this podcast. Really appreciate it. And again, I'm just always grateful for you telling us this story, this side of you.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.